This is the Victoria Fraternal 2026. Our speaker is our brother Tim Stiles. His overall theme for the weekend is Gideon, Treasure in Earthen Vessels. And this is his class 4, entitled Ephraim, Earrings, and an Ephod. Brother Tim.
Thanks, Brother Matt, and good morning, everyone. Excellent. How do you respond when your effort in the ecclesia, your active service that you do for the ecclesia is, by all accounts, blessed by our Heavenly Father and then criticized by those around you? That's what happens to Gideon this morning. We left this man on the heights of victory, having chased the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, having called Ephraim to pull the nation together. Ephraim's responded to the call. They've cut off Oreb and Zeb. They've killed them. And then when we turn to chapter 8, it's like, hang on. What's happening? Because what happens next almost seems out of place. It's quite unexpected, coming hard on the heels of the victories and the glories of chapter 7 and the great things that God has done for them. As chapter 8 begins, you almost find yourself saying, is there something that happened that we didn't know about or wasn't recorded? Because Ephraim was called to help in the battle. That's what we left Gideon off with at the end of chapter 7 yesterday. The problem was they just didn't like when they were called. It's so typical of our flesh, isn't it? Instead of focusing on what God has accomplished so far up to this point and all his goodness, let's pick apart the things that we don't feel like we personally had enough input on or feel slighted by. It's a dangerous spirit of discontentment that Ephraim shows, and yet we know that it's so easy for all of us to fall into that spirit. That it didn't go the way that they thought it should have, and it could have gone better if you had asked for my input. But that's the nature of being in a leadership position like Gideon was. It's easy to pick apart and complain about things that were done different than to how I would have done them, and to forget to just thank God, to praise God for the good work that he's accomplishing in us. But how Gideon responds to this is remarkable. When you work hard in some effort in the truth, only to then have it be criticized, what does the mind of the flesh say? I don't know what your mind says, but my mind says things like, I'm done. I'm not getting involved anymore. People don't appreciate my efforts. I work hard, and this is how people respond. Why would I even contribute anymore? Brothers and sisters, this is so real for all of us, isn't it? And yet, that is so opposite to Gideon's response. His spirit is captured in what will later be penned in the book of Proverbs. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city. Just consider how apt those words are in this context. Look at a map of the tribal areas again. Here's the map we put up yesterday. Gideon could have said in response to them, he could have said, well, look, guys, I just called the tribes that made sense to call. I called the ones that were closest to the battle. And then, you know, because that's who he called, Asher and Naphtali and Zebulun. We can talk after about where's Issachar and all of this. Why didn't they come? But interestingly, the battle happens right in Issachar's territory. So that might give us a hint as to why he didn't call them. He could have said, I called the people that it made sense to call. And then as soon as it made sense to call you, Ephraim, as the Midianites were fleeing down here, that's what I did. I called you when it made sense to get you involved. But he doesn't even say that. He doesn't justify himself. In fact, he doesn't even say, the Spirit of Yahweh was upon me when I did all of this. So back off. None of that is what's what is in Gideon's response. His soft answer melts their bitterness. He didn't defend himself to them. And here's, I think, why. Because he cared more about preserving the unity of the tribes than about proving that he was right. And that is a spirit that thinks so far outside itself. He reminds them in verse 2 of how significant their contributions were. Look how much you've helped. Just the gleanings of the grapes. Well, let's read it. What have I done now in comparison of you, Ephraim? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Just the gleanings that you've done is better than the whole harvest that we've done. And remember, gleanings occurred after the men of the field had gone through and picked out most of what was there. Think of Ruth, for example. The gleaners picked what was left over. And Gideon's saying, the work that you did at the end of the battle is more significant than all the harvest we did of the Midianites at the beginning. He's effectively telling them, your contribution was invaluable. Because a soft answer turns away wrath. And it did for the men of Ephraim as well. But you know what? Sadly, this kind of behavior seems to be characteristic of the men of Ephraim. They made this same exact, almost verbatim complaint to Jephthah later in chapter 12 when he didn't call them to help defeat the Ammonites. And they're prepared in chapter 12 to burn down Jephthah's house because of their complaint. But Jephthah calls them out on it. He says, I called and you didn't come. And so what he does is he gathers the men of Gilead, he smites Ephraim on the east side of Jordan, and then this is that story, remember, where he sends the men of Gilead ahead of the Ephraimites to the river before the Ephraimites get there, and there's that situation where, you know, can you say Shibboleth? And they would say, Sibboleth. No, say it again, Shibboleth, Sibboleth. And that's how he differentiated between the people. That's that lovely little story later on in Judges. And how is that divine vengeance? Ooh, this is how God works sometimes. Because it's at the very same place where the men of Ephraim had back in chapter 8 overtaken Oreb and Zeb, end of chapter 7 actually. God brings them back to the very same place and says, you haven't learned the lesson. You've still got that same problem in your character, and that's where they meet their end. But what's the difference between these two events? Why does Gideon respond with such patience and a spirit of soft answer turns away wrath? And Jephthah has a very different response. Is it because we might say, well, they're just two different people? I guess you'd want to deal with Gideon, not Jephthah. No, it's because the men of Ephraim had come when they were called. They'd been involved. They were prepared to put their hand to the work. But not in chapter 12. They didn't call. They didn't respond. And that's the differentiating factor. And the reason we know that's the differentiating factor is because of this curious incident that happens right after this, which we'll come to in just a minute with Succoth and Penuel. Because having dealt with the Ephraimites, in verse 4, it says that Gideon carried on with the 300 in the pursuit. Do you see that little phrase that Brother Matt read at the end? I think that's such a powerful little phrase. They were faint, yet pursuing them, exhausted, but not giving up. Isn't that what 2 Thessalonians 3 says? Be not weary in well-doing, because in due season we will reap if we faint not. His determination is so great that he's going to cover hundreds of kilometers. When if we drew on the map, if we extended this out over here, they end up covering hundreds of kilometers in pursuit of the Midianites. They didn't stop at the Jordan River. Why not? Well, because the spirit of, if you were from the tribe of Manasseh, you didn't stop at the Jordan River like most other tribes did. They didn't push them across the Jordan and say, good enough, at least we have this geographical barrier now. No, they pursued them straight across the Jordan because Gideon saw the value in pushing them out completely. He could have said, well, it's not our job anymore. Let the people on the east side of the Jordan take care of it. But that was not his spirit. Why? Because he's more concerned about the unity of the tribes than just himself. And he remembered clearly the bitter experience of the subjection for 7 years to this group of people. The job's not done. We need to get rid of it completely. But unfortunately, not everyone in Israel shared that spirit of zeal and enthusiasm and commitment. And the rivalry among the tribes was even more fragmented than we saw with Ephraim. Because in verse 9, there's this curious incident that we don't often learn in Sunday school with Succoth and Penuel. What is going on with these two cities? These two cities are just outside the border of Manasseh. And that becomes important. Because as Gideon and his faithful group of 300 continue in their relentless pursuit, they come to these cities, and he makes the same request of both of them. You saw that. It's almost like the record is written in such a way to move past these men as quickly as possible. But we don't want to do that. He says in verse 5, "Give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they are faint. And I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian." So he's saying, please, we're exhausted. Look at my men. Please, can we have some bread? We're pursuing your enemies and ours. And the response of both cities is the same. Verse 6, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we should give bread unto your enemy?" And it says in verse 8 that the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. So they have the same response. So what are we to take from these interactions? Why does God record this part of the record? Well, some commentators suggest that this is where Gideon begins his quick demise. That he took matters into his own hands, that he has a spirit of vengeful hatred, and like a tyrant, now we see Gideon's colors coming out, exacting retribution as he saw fit to fulfill a measure of perhaps personal vendetta against other tribes. But I think, brothers and sisters and young people, there is so much more going on here than that. What's the contrast between the men of Succoth and Penuel and the men of Ephraim? Well, wouldn't we say that one was prepared to get involved and the other was not? There's hard work to do. And Ephraim was willing, and the men of Succoth and Penuel were not. Because there's risk involved. Remember the context. Put yourself in the shoes of a father or mother in Succoth and Penuel. You have limited supplies of food because Midian for 7 years has been romping through the land and taking the increase of the land. And now Gideon comes along and says, can we have some of what precious little you have? Well, it depends, Gideon. Is the enemy defeated? Do you have Zeba and Zalmunna in your hand? To which, of course, the answer is no. So do you see how effectively this becomes a question about trust and faith that God and Gideon are able to complete the work that they've started? And this is why their refusal to help is met with such a strong response from Gideon. He's rebuking them for their lack of appreciation for God's principles. Not only are they not prepared to take up the battle themselves, they're not even willing to help other people who are taking up the battle. This is extreme self-interest and self-preservation set in strong contrast to the men of Ephraim. And that's, I think, why Gideon handled it so differently, so patiently with one and so strong with another. Yes, the men of Ephraim had been critical and complaining, but they had gotten involved. But the men of Succoth and Penuel refused to even get involved, even just by providing food for the needs of those who were working. But despite their unwilling spirit, Gideon doesn't give up in God's good work. And I think that's what's really lovely in this, that at the end of verse 4, he was faint yet pursuing. And he goes to those who should have been supportive to the work and were not and were critical. And yet he continues pursuing. And Sukkoth and Penuel, what we have essentially is two different attitudes towards the work and the service that needs to be done. In Sukkoth, there's this indifference and an unwillingness to work in the truth. Their attitude was, well, you haven't even caught them yet. Why should we risk everything giving you our precious stores of bread when there's great risk to us if we do that? We are, after all, on the eastern side of the Jordan. So we are easier pickings for the enemy until you defeat them. Easy for you to ask for bread, Gideon, in your comfy house in Ophrah on the west side of the Jordan. And in Penuel, there's this spirit of self-confidence. Well, why do we say that? How do we know that there's this spirit of self-confidence? Well, do you see how Gideon identifies that spirit? Because in verse 9, his response to their refusal, he says unto them, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. And I think that gives us an insight into Gideon is cutting right to the heart of what their problem is. He's going to break down this tower. Well, where else have we seen this idea of breaking down in the life of Gideon? Well, he is the breaker down. He's the hewer down. It's the same phrase that was used back in chapter 6. Just as he started his work with breaking down idolatry, now Gideon says he's going to break down this object that they rely and depend and trust in so heavily. Perhaps the men of this city thought that, well, we don't need your protection, Gideon. We have this tower. And Gideon says, I'm going to break down this object in which you trust. Do you know, this city of Penuel comes up in one other place. Do you know who rebuilt the city of Penuel in the time of the kings? Jeroboam. Doesn't that just give perhaps another small insight into what the city of Penuel's problem was? Because in the very same context in 1 Kings 12, verse 25, where he sets up this rival system of worship, and what does he put there? He puts there objects like golden calves built around idolatry. So we see the story that these two cities tell, that Gideon's identifying a problem with their attitude. And in both cases, he makes it clear there's no place for that in the warfare of faith. And really, at the core of the attitude of both of these cities, as we said, is a lack of belief that God can and will finish what he started. That Midian is as good as defeated, which is why when they say, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna even in your hand? Gideon's answer would be, they will be. Trust God. He will finish what he started. And because you're not, your lack of faith is going to be your downfall. Now, before we come to verse 11 and miss what just happened, let's just remember that in verse 4, as we said, Gideon's men are faint and pursuing. They've chased Midian through the hills and the valleys for the better part of 50 kilometers at this point. They've stopped to ask for bread and help and supplies in Sukkoth and Penuel, and they refused. But they keep going, because sometimes faithfulness means continuing in the work when you have very little left to give. So do you see how the persistent and zealous spirit of Gideon and his men is set in such strong contrast to the unwillingness and apathy of Sukkoth and Penuel? In fact, so zealous and persistent were Gideon and his men, and so far have they pursued Zebah and Zalmunna up to this point, that when they catch up with them, look at what it says in verse 11. Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in the tents on the east of Nob and Jogbeha, and smote the host. Now the King James says, for the host was secure. Now perhaps your Bible has something different. Maybe yours says something like, the host felt secure, or the host was confident, or unsuspecting, as several of the other translations say. And I think the reason they felt secure is because this is very far away from where the battle began. And it's as though the response of the host is, hang on, Gideon's here? You mean he's continue chasing us all this way? But doesn't that just speak to where God has brought this man to? A man who started so cautious and hesitant, and now he is just out like a rocket in hot pursuit, relentless, not stopping. Now, for sake of time, we're going to move past his return trip over the next several verses through Succoth and Penuel, where he responds to them and he punishes them. And we're going to mostly skip over verses 18 to 21 and the killing of Ziba and Zalmunna. As much as we would love to, it was just, you know, we had to pick and choose because there's just so much good material in this section of the story of Gideon. But what we do want to just notice, without skipping over entirely verses 18 to 21, do you notice, and we mentioned this yesterday, that this is where Gideon had told them in verse 19, that the men that had previously been slain, they were my brethren, the sons of my mother. As Yahweh lives, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you. We want to notice two important details in these few verses. The first one is that, as we mentioned yesterday, not only is there a sword, but the record just doesn't mention it. So do you see that in verse 20? That he said to Jether, his firstborn, up and slay them. Well, hang on. How would you slay them? I didn't think there was any swords back in chapter 7. Well, there perhaps were. God just didn't need their swords. But the other important point we want to notice is we don't want to miss through all of this where Gideon's mind is at in chapter 8. Because as we said, some would suggest that this is where Gideon's spiritual demise is evident. He's taking vengeance where he ought not to. He's overreaching. He's taking matters into his own hands, hatefully treating Succoth and Penuel and acting more like a tyrant than a faithful leader for God. But before we conclude that, and before we suggest that he's abandoned the spiritual character that we've been watching God nurture and develop, just notice what the record repeatedly says that he does. Because when the men of Ephraim chided with him back in verse 1 and 2, who does Gideon take everyone's mind to in that moment? He says, God has delivered Midian into your hand. And then when Succoth refused to provide the help that he needed in verse 6, who does Gideon elevate to the fore again? He says in verse 7, Yahweh will deliver Ziba and Zalmunna into your hands. And then when Ziba and Zalmunna now are about to be slain, in verse 19, who does Gideon call upon as a witness to the fact that it was because of their brutal treatment of his brethren that he's now going to slay them? He says, as Yahweh lives. And the reason that's important is because we need to take that context into the next several verses. Gideon's not on a downward spiral or a personal vengeance tour. In fact, in verse 22, with a perfect opportunity to succumb to that kind of personal agenda of executing a vendetta and taking authority with absolute power, we actually find him doing the exact opposite. This is not a man who has conquered the Midianites with a personal desire to now be set up as the king. That's what the people want to do. Do you see that in verse 22? Look at all the emphasis that they put on him. And wouldn't this be so difficult when someone comes up to you for some good work that you've done? Do you see the contrast that is set up here? The chapter started with Gideon being criticized for a good work that he's done and how he responded to criticism. And now it says, though, God is saying, okay, well, how will you respond to abundant praise? Because look at this, verse 22. Rule thou over us, Gideon, both thou and thy son, and thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. Who is getting all the praise in verse 22? It's all about you, Gideon. Thou, 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 thou. Do you see how Gideon is the focus of verse 22. The people want to make him king, and their focus is placed squarely on him. But Gideon has learned what he's been told from the very beginning. Remember how this all started? His very first commission, back in chapter 6 with the angel, is that this is all about Midian being in his hand because God put them there. He hadn't delivered anyone. God had done it all. And Gideon understood that. And he responds directly and summarily to their desire. Oh, isn't this so hard when someone comes and it's just... Maybe it's easier when someone comes and puts so much focus on this amazing work you've done in the ecclesia and you feel like this is a bit uncomfortable. Let's not forget we're all in this. But what about when it's subtle and when the flesh sort of likes that praise? But Gideon's response is, I will not rule over you, verse 23, and neither will my son rule over you. Why? Because God rules over you. Do you see how crystal clear that was in his mind? He shows remarkable clarity of thinking in a very emotionally charged, appealing to the flesh situation. They finally rid themselves of all their enemies. He's led them all to victory. Zeba ends up, Midian is slain. He has been the representative man. It was by his hand that God done all of this in a period of time when, do you remember that phrase that's so common in the book of Judges? There was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. For the longest time as a kid, I always thought that just meant we haven't yet arrived at the book of Kings. But that's not what it's saying at all. There was a king in Israel during the period of the judges, but the people were living like there wasn't and doing what was right in their own eyes. But Gideon realized who was king all along. He says, God is your king. Now, in light of that, and everything that we've come to know of Gideon up to this point, what happens at the end of this story is perhaps at first a bit disappointing. It's curious, to say the least. So we just want to take a few minutes to look closely at this incident in the next few verses and see if we can piece together what's happening, why it's happening, and what the result was. So verse 24, Gideon said unto the people who he has just said, I will not be your king, Yahweh will rule over you. He says, I would desire a request of you, that you would give me every man the earrings of his prey, for they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. Well, why does Gideon ask for earrings? And why just earrings? We find in verse 26 that they give him more than that, but why does he just ask for earrings? Well, where is the last time in Scripture that we heard of golden earrings before this? And the answer is Numbers 31. What's Numbers 31 about? It's about Moses' last commission that God gave him for Israel to avenge themselves of the Midianites because of the incident of Baal Peor. And after they had slain all the Midianites, it says in Numbers 31 that the officers came to Moses and they say to him in verse 49, we won't turn back there for sake of time, but Numbers 31, verse 49, the officers come to him and say, Moses, we've counted and we haven't lost a single man in the battle. And therefore, we're going to bring a voluntary, willing offering from our own stuff, from our own spoils of war, which included, lo and behold, golden earrings. So the spoils of war in Numbers 31, when the Midianites were blotted out, included golden earrings. To see how some of these pieces are similar in this story. And when is the last time before Numbers 31? Because if we just reach back to 1 and say, well, that's convenient, we found something that tells a story. But what about the time before that? The next time we hear about golden earrings? Well, We'd have to go back to Exodus 35. You see, golden earrings don't come up very often in Scripture. And in Exodus 35, Israel, it says, brought a willing offering for the articles and the service of the tabernacle. And among those items that they brought were earrings. So then what we're finding is that in Exodus 35, the offering from the people for the service of the tabernacle included golden earrings that were given willingly. And in Numbers 31, the spoils of war from the defeat of the Midianites included golden earrings that were given willingly. And what does it say in Judges 8, verse 25? That the people brought the golden earrings. It says, they answered, "We will willingly give them." And they spread a garment and did cast therein every man the earrings of his prey. So there seems to be some similarities that are going on in this story. Who received the golden earrings as the offering from the officers in Numbers 31? They were given to the priests. The record says that they brought it to Moses, and Moses and Eleazar the priest was standing there with him. Now, why is that significant? Well, because what do we find that Gideon does with these golden earrings? And let's not forget as well that in Exodus 35, they brought these golden earrings for the tabernacle. And who serves in the tabernacle? The priest serves in the tabernacle. And Gideon takes these golden earrings, the spoil of the victory over the Midianites that were given willingly by the people, and he makes an ephod. Who wears an ephod? A priest wears an ephod. The high priest, in fact. Do you see how the circumstances of Judges 8 are very similar to Numbers 31 and Exodus 35? Perhaps this is very fresh in Gideon's mind. But why then? Why make an ephod? Why make this article so closely associated with the priesthood? And why is this included in the record after giving us the account of such a humble, God-fearing, virtuous, idolatry-hating man? What are we to take from these events? We have to put all these pieces together, and they need to fit together. Well, the record really doesn't give us much to go on, but perhaps by putting some of the pieces together, we can get a fuller picture of what's going on. But we need a few more pieces. In Exodus 28, when God gave Moses instructions for all the parts of the high priest's garment that needed to be made and how to make them, the very first article that gets explained is the ephod. And it's not because it was the first thing that the high priest would put on. It's not like God was explaining from the first layer to the last in order of how to get dressed if you were a high priest. It was actually the outermost garment that they put on, the one that would be the most visible on the priest. That becomes significant. It's also the one to which so many other pieces of the high priest's garments were attached. The curious girdle, as it calls it in the King James. I love that phrase, the curious girdle. Isn't that just such a curious way to describe something? The curious girdle, the two onyx stones that went on either shoulder, the settings of gold to which were attached the gold chains that were attached to the breastplate, and then the breastplate were the stones, and in the breastplate was the Urim and Thummim. And then, when God gave those instructions in Exodus 28, then instructions given for the robe of the ephod and the coat of fine linen. It's clearly given a place of preeminence with respect to all the other parts of the high priest's garments. In fact, we find that later in Israel's history, it was so closely connected with the breastplate that when David wants to inquire of Yahweh, he asks for the ephod to be brought, because it was understood at that time that the ephod and the breastplate and the Urim and the Thummim at which they could inquire of God, they were all inseparably linked. Okay, so there's another piece. Well, next we want to briefly establish and remind ourselves when this takes place, okay? In the context of the story of Gideon. That's fairly straightforward to establish, because when Gideon asks for the golden earrings from the people, he calls them in verse 24 the earrings of the prey, as though these were the spoils of recent victory. And further to this, we find immediately after this event with the ephod, in verse 28, the divine summary is, "Thus was Midian subdued," which would indicate that this incident with the ephod happens right in the same context of Midian being overcome. Zebah and Zalmunna have just been destroyed. So that would mean that we're on fairly safe ground to understand that verse 24 is happening immediately after verse 23, just the way it's recorded. We'll hang on to that thought as well, because those are some of the maybe the easier pieces. Now you might think, well, that was not easy. But we've reached back into Numbers 32, Exodus 35. Now we need to come to the question of why Gideon made the ephod. Because there was already a priesthood in the nation, right? Was he making this as an idol? Has Gideon apostatized so quickly? Well, where was the priesthood and the tabernacle during the whole period of the book of Judges? Do you remember? Because it wasn't in Jerusalem yet. That doesn't come for a while. What city was it located in? It was in Shiloh. And which tribal territory is Shiloh in? Oh, it's in Ephraim. Oh, we've heard about Ephraim already in this chapter. It's almost as though God is giving us this little indication, like, put the pieces together. Well, what does Ephraim have to do with Gideon's ephod? Because, yes, we heard about them earlier in the chapter, but that was seemingly a very different incident. So to answer that, we just need to take a quick review of what we know about this tribe and their history. Do you remember that incident in Numbers 25 we've alluded to a couple of times with Baal Peor, where there was a man from Simeon who had gone and lain with a woman of Midian at the door of the tabernacle? And you may remember that as a result, Simeon loses tens of thousands of men in their tribe. And we can establish that. We did this with the young people. Young people, remember this? We looked at that very, what we call the very boring chart with all the numbers in Numbers 1. And then when we look at Numbers, I think it was 36. I can't remember off the top of my head. We can establish that Simeon lost tens of thousands of men because of that incident. Do you know who lost the next most men? It was the tribe of Ephraim. Now, taken just by itself, that would be a mere assertion and maybe an unsafe deduction. But see how this continues. Because what else do we know of the men of Ephraim? Well, we know, just from what we just read at the beginning of chapter 8, that the men of this tribe were given to contention. They have unfairly criticized Gideon at the beginning of the chapter, despite Gideon's wonderful response and how he handles them. We also know that they heard Gideon's words of, "I will not be your king." Remember, he said that back in verse 23. "I will not be your king. My sons will not be your king." And then what do they do immediately after Gideon's death in chapter 9 as it opens? They set up Gideon's son, who he specifically said will not be your king. And they take Abimelech and they set him up as the king. Well, how do we know that the men of Ephraim were involved in that? Because the record tells us that Abimelech's mother was from Ephraim. And they didn't set him up as king in his hometown of Ophrah. They set him up in Ephraim. And then in almost a repeat, as we said, of chapter 8, they bring similarly unfounded, ridiculous accusations against Jephthah in chapter 12. And years later, in the time of the kings, when Solomon dies and the kingdom is divided and Rehoboam reigns in Judah, who reigns in Israel? It was Jeroboam. And where was Jeroboam from? He was from Ephraim. And where does he set up his two golden calves to rival the temple in Jerusalem? In Bethel, a city of Ephraim, and Dan, not a city in Ephraim. But why does he set it up in Dan? Because do you remember that interesting story at the end of the book of Judges in chapter 17 where Micah comes, that story of Micah who is set up as a priest. Guess what tribe Micah is from? Micah is from Ephraim. And Jeroboam takes his inspiration from this man from Ephraim, where Micah had started that in the city of Dan. You see all these links to Ephraim in the story and what the Bible is painting as a caricature of this tribe. Right through Israel's history, Ephraim becomes a term that even the prophets later on, like Zechariah, will use to differentiate the Jews who have for 2,500 years been dispersed outside the land, referred to in many places as Ephraim, as distinct from those who are inside the land. And this spirit of envy would continue well. It would continue all the way until the return of Christ, because Isaiah 11, verse 13 says that in that day the envy of Ephraim shall depart. They shall no longer envy Judah. And despite the fact that the center of worship was in Shiloh, in Ephraim, no spiritual leader ever came from Ephraim in the book of Judges except for one, and it wasn't a man, because there was no man to be found in the whole tribe who God could use to deliver Israel. So he raised up Deborah, a woman from Ephraim, and when she needs to go find Barak to help her, where does she find Barak? Not in Ephraim. She has to go to Naphtali to find a spiritual leader that can help her. And there's nothing good from Ephraim in the rest of the period of Judges. In fact, what's happening in Shiloh, when we close the book on Judges and we turn to the book of Samuel, we find Eli and his sons. But then God will raise up out of very dry spiritual ground a man from Ephraim named Samuel. So we have a tribe that during this period of Israel's history is consistently contentious, cantankerous, spiritually floundering and depraved in terms of leadership. Because for that matter, where are the faithful priests in the book of Judges? They're almost entirely absent except for Phinehas in chapter 20. But we know that that's very early in the chronological time frame of the book. And then the priesthood disappears from the rest of the book of Judges. Where are the faithful Levites in the book of Judges? They too are entirely absent, not around to lead the nation in spiritual worship. Where are the altars in the book of Judges? Only a few. There's one that Manoah made. There's the one that the people made in Judges 21 after destroying the tribe of Benjamin. And there's the one that Gideon made. But there's never any priests mentioned doing any offerings. And I think all of this is why it says in Psalm 78 that they provoked God to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their graven images, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he placed among men. Moreover, he refused the tabernacle of Joseph and chose not the tribe of Ephraim. Well, what does all that have to do with Gideon's ephod? The answer is, Ephraim was meant to be the center of religious worship in Israel. And although they were the tribe from which Joshua arose, they had become totally spiritually corrupt. And it would remain that way for several generations after Gideon. So when we put all these pieces together then, all of this may help us understand what Gideon was thinking when he made the ephod. Because with the Midianites now exterminated, he looked around and he knew he was not destined to be a king, because God was the king. And he looked around and knew that God had not called him to be a prophet. Why? Because a prophet had already been sent to Gideon and his people back in chapter 6. And he looked around and there was not a priest anywhere to be found. Not even so much as a faithful Levite. So I think Gideon looked around and said, the people need a faithful priesthood. And I'm not of Aaron's lineage. I'm not of the tribe even of Levi. So I can't really be a true priest But they're nowhere to be found. So we need something that will bring the people's mind back to a faithful priesthood. Did he have good reason to believe that God would be okay with this? I think he did. Verse 27 says that he made an ephod from the spoils of Midian, and he put it in his city, even in Ophrah. Why did he put it in Ophrah? Why in his city and not in Shiloh? Well, because Ophrah was where Baal worship had already been eradicated. Ophrah's inhabitants had been cleansed from apostasy. They had rallied behind Gideon in that effort. And Ophrah was where, in his first act, with divine approval from God, he had offered a sacrifice that Yahweh accepted, which would normally have been the work of a priest, especially the offering that he offered in that time. We didn't look at it, but it was the minka that he offered. And so Shiloh, by contrast, is full of apostasy. And Gideon looks at that and says, well, we need to get away from Shiloh, because that is leading the people astray. And then he looked at the situation and his own situation and said, perhaps God will allow us to bring the priesthood here, at least in principle, to Ophrah, where Baal worship has been destroyed, our enemies have been defeated, and now what we need is to restore right worship in the nation. In fact, do you remember, just flick back to chapter 6. Do you remember in verse 34, it said, the Spirit of Yahweh came upon Gideon. Now, if you have an AV margin like mine, for came, next to the word came, it might say, it clothed Gideon. There are at least 25 other occurrences in the Old Testament where that word is translated as clothed. And it's in the books of Exodus and Leviticus and Ezekiel 44 and 2 Chronicles 24, verse 20. And all of them are in the context of the priesthood. And in fact, of all the other occurrences where the phrase the Spirit of God came upon so-and-so, like Jephthah, or the Spirit of God came upon Samson, or the Spirit of God came upon Saul, or David, or Elisha, or Azariah, or Zechariah, it's a different word. It doesn't use that word clothed. It uses a different word in every one of those places except for one, where it says the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah. It uses that word clothed. And Zechariah was a priest. So what that's certainly leading us to is the fact that God has already linked this faithful leader to the priesthood when he placed his Spirit upon him. He clothed him with his Spirit. And in a godless society where priests were absent, perhaps Gideon's trying to bring back the priesthood before the nation. He's trying to get worship on the right track again, and he makes this ephod as a means to facilitate that and to be a visible token, a reminder for the people, just like the serpent on the pole in Numbers 21 was a reminder, that this is what God desires in acceptable worship in the tabernacle. I think, brothers and sisters, we're on very safe ground to say Gideon was not making an idol. He was making a memorial. But tragically, verse 27 tells us that all Israel went thither a-whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. You might have in your margin, as I do, Psalm 106. Psalm 106 is often cited in connection here because it uses that same word for snare. But I'm going to suggest that Psalm 106 actually is not talking about Gideon. It's talking about a different period in Israel's history in the book of Judges, because the context of Psalm 106 just doesn't really match up with Gideon's actions and his behavior. It says in verse 34, they did not destroy the nations concerning whom Yahweh commanded them. But Gideon did destroy. In fact, he relentlessly pursued Midian. It goes on to say in verse 35, they were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. But Gideon refused to mingle. He pursued Zeba and Zalmunna hundreds of kilometers in order to make sure that Israel didn't mingle. And they served their idols, it says in verse 36, which were a snare unto them. But this is Gideon we're talking about, whose very first act was to obliterate idolatry. I think Psalm 106 is talking about a different period of time than Gideon, which still leaves us with the question, well, what happened? How did it become a snare? How did Israel go whoring after it? And the record is scarce in the details, so we can't really conjecture. Well, we could conjecture, but it would perhaps be unwise to do so. So maybe we will just a little. Perhaps, and we take this as using examples from elsewhere in Scripture, perhaps it became an object of superstition, like the ark did later on in 1 Samuel 4. Now, that's worth noting that there was nothing wrong with the ark. There was something wrong with how the people viewed the ark. Or perhaps over time it became venerated too highly, as the temple later would be. That's also worth remembering. There was nothing wrong with the temple. It was the problem with the people who viewed it incorrectly, and it became a snare for them. Or perhaps he was making something which they could use to consult the Urim and the Thummim at, as they did in Exodus 28, or as David did on multiple occasions. Whatever the case, we aren't told how it became a snare, just that it became one. Like a noose that's used to catch an animal, this object that had been made for no doubt the right reasons, and was indeed a thing that could be used for good, became a snare. An animal that walks into a snare has no idea that what's about to happen is life-threatening and will eventually kill them. But that's the whole point of a snare. They're put in places where the prey won't even notice and can't even see it until it's walked into it. There's a tragic irony in the fact that our story began with Gideon tearing down the altar of Baal in his father's house, after which all Israel had gone astray. And now at the end, there is a snare in his own house again, after which all Israel will go astray. There is a powerful warning, brothers and sisters, from this incident with the ephod. The most unexpected, the most unlikely thing, even if acquired for the right reasons and with the best of intentions, can become a snare if we're not careful. Anyone can be snared by even the most harmless-looking, even holy thing. Anyone can be snared by an act of service that could be a good thing. Ecclesial service can become about public acknowledgement instead of about service to our God. Our Bible knowledge can become about intellectual superiority over others or showing off how much we know. Ecclesial involvement can become about how much influence we possess. The more I attend, the more I will be respected and my input will be sought. Even a good habit can become compulsive in an unhealthy way. A legitimate, innocuous interest can crowd out more important spiritual priorities. A useful device can become something that we just can't live without. Anything can become a snare if we stop evaluating what it's doing in our spiritual life. Is there some sin or struggle for which you can look back on and recall clearly that there is that moment when you let it into your life months or years ago, even though you were well-meaning and without evil intent at the time? I know I have those, and I can still look back at them. And has that thing, even something that began as a good thing, now become a snare that's taken hold? What will you do about it? Once you've had your neck caught in a snare and escaped with your life, why would you go back to it? But we do. And each time the snare tightens a little more around the neck. And each time it leaves another painful mark upon us, like it does on an animal. I think at some point Gideon realized this. How long it went on for as a snare, we can't be sure, but it would seem that he did come to that realization. Why do we suggest that? Because by the end of verse 28, we find that the land has quietness for 40 years. It's the same word that describes the rest that followed the judgeship of Othniel in chapter 3 and Ehud in chapter 3 and Deborah and Barak in chapter 5. God gave the land rest. And if Israel had been ensnared all that time back in idolatry, we would hardly expect that the land would be at rest for 40 years. And further evidence is found in verse 29. Because verse 29 says, Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Why was that name given to him in the first place? Because he was the one who contended with Baal and cast it down. Because he had hewn down Baal's altar and restored the people to Yahweh. And it would be fitting here then if he's referred to once again with that name, having brought the people back to God. But it would be terribly unfitting if he has just led them back to idolatry to refer to him that way. And as a third piece of evidence, verse 33 reads as though the people remained faithful to Yahweh, but sadly only as long as Gideon lived, because the impact of his work was, as with most of the judges, only temporary. But for 40 years, Israel enjoyed rest under the hand of Gideon, this mighty man of valor whose leadership inspired other people to follow him, to look at him and do as he did. As he said back in chapter 7, this man who destroyed the power of sin so completely that Midian will never again lift up its head, is what it says in verse 28. Doesn't that just sound like someone who crushes the head of a serpent? And in doing so, the record closes in verse 35, telling us that he showed goodness unto Israel. Goodness that would still be remembered 450 years later in Isaiah 9, because his deliverance and destruction of the power of sin was so complete. Well, let's just conclude with a couple of takeaway points. Perhaps you have other things that you've taken, which is great as well. How we respond to contentions, even when we are wrongfully accused, even when our effort is belittled or criticized, will determine whether a situation is inflamed or dissolved. And the second one, just two for this morning, we have to continually examine, brothers and sisters, in our homes and in our individual circumstances, even in our own minds, the things that maybe started as a good thing, but have quietly become a snare. The scary thing about a snare is that you don't necessarily recognize it when you step into it. You know, Gideon's counted among those in Hebrews 11 of whom there was much to say and not enough time to write, is what the writer to the Hebrews says. And in our exhortation, God willing, we'll see that he stands as an example for men and women of every generation since then, who from meager origins, who think they're nothing special, God can raise up to do great things because his strength is made perfect. It's manifest completely in your weakest moments.